The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off in the relationships section. The lessons I learned riding shotgun in my dad's Nissan. Over years of Sunday drives with her father, a young woman learned where she came from and who she wanted to be. This article is by Lindsay Karp. On our way to my grandfather's home one Sunday afternoon during my junior year of high school, I learned two lessons I'll never forget. It's important to look people in their eyes when they're speaking, my father advised, as we sat side by side in his Nissan Pathfinder. Eye contact shows you're listening and interested in what someone's saying. I took mental notes from the passenger seat. Every Sunday during my 1990s childhood, my father and I drove round trip from the suburbs into northeast Philadelphia to bring my grandfather to our house for a family meal. And for an hour each week, my typically reserved father shared advice and stories from his earlier years as we drove backward into his childhood to the home where he grew from a boy to a man. "Be thankful for every day," he told me. Often, he reinforced the benefits of waking early on a weekend morning, celebrating how he watered his garden and mowed the lawn before the midday heat and still had plenty of time to prepare a gourmet family meal. Listen carefully and ask questions. People like talking about themselves. I channeled this while interviewing for my first job and leading my first meeting at work. I still follow this advice regularly when new people enter my life and conversations commence. Stories of his 1960s childhood came to life as we passed buildings he knew from long ago. That store was the butcher, and this one was the tailor who hemmed my pants. He spoke of his father working 6 days a week as an upholsterer to support their modest row home, and how summers in northeast Philadelphia were never lonely because everyone lived outdoors on their front stoop. He described baking with his mother on frigid winter days, and how it was his job to shell and chop the walnuts while she added ingredients to the Sunbeam mixer. I learned how their tiny home would fill with family and friends on holidays, and how special that was at a time when luxuries like a second pair of shoes or a vacation weren't possible. From the passenger seat, I learned of my late grandmother's Sunday dinners and how her devotion to bringing the family together weekly translated to my father wanting to do the same. When we laughed about how she snuck Worcestershire sauce into every pot, the car would magically fill with phantom smells of her spaghetti and meatballs, a coveted meal I'd last had when I was little. I'd salivate as I recalled the taste of her velvety chocolate cheesecake brownies from when I was five. And then I'd picture her in the fuzzy slippers and striped apron she wore to every Sunday dinner. My grandmother's dormant voice came alive from deep within my memories as my father shared the words she'd said to him repeatedly. "You are smart and can do anything you put your mind to." He admitted that she was the reason he had the confidence to be the first in their family to go to college. During these weekly car rides, a beautiful portrait of my grandmother was painted in my mind, despite losing her when I was only six. These car rides occurred weekly, from the time I was in elementary school and my feet barely reached the floor until the end of my senior year of high school, when my father was battling stage 4 tongue cancer. Instead of driving into Philadelphia, I'd find him lying in bed, resting a body weary from chemotherapy and radiation, imagining the pain he endured losing his mother to cancer only a decade prior. I knew I wasn't strong enough to do the same. He entered remission, but I left for college at Penn State soon after, and found myself wishing I could return to that passenger seat, to the warmth of Sunday conversations and classic rock pulsing in the background. With 200 miles now between us, these car rides were no longer possible. Then, in 2017, when I was 34, I was officially diagnosed with multiple sclerosis after years of symptoms, and I struggled to drive distances. My family and I had recently bought our forever home in my hometown, and my father became my personal Uber driver, shuttling me from the suburbs to my neurology appointments in Philadelphia. We were back in our routine, albeit for less than ideal reasons. Now, the unease that consumes me prior to doctor's appointments and infusion therapies is calmed by car rides that deliver the familiar comfort of Sunday afternoons from my childhood. Classic rock still plays in the background, as if I'm 17 and listening intently as my father explains the importance of being aware of my surroundings when walking alone. But when I look over at the driver's seat, I see a full head of white hair because the grandfather of my two boys is sitting beside me. 2 decades later, so much has changed, but just enough remains the same. Yesterday, as my 12-year-old and I were driving in the car, Layla came on the radio. I was instantly transported to my father's Pathfinder. As I looked in the rearview mirror, I saw my son. But in him, I also saw my younger self. "I have something important to tell you," I informed him. He looked up, listening intently. When someone's talking to you, it's important to look them in the eyes. It shows them you care about what they're saying. He sat there, quietly absorbing my words. I've come to realize that within a moving car, life's stressors are on pause, and the ability to savor the moment makes for the perfect time to receive advice. With limited distractions from the outside world, conversation flows and bonds are strengthened enough to last a lifetime. Just like that, the car rides I came to love so deeply shifted to the next generation. And now, the steering wheel is in my hands. We're over in Welcome to Oprah's Insider, Oprah's Advice for Newlyweds. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, insiders. Well, here we are with wedding season upon us. Can you believe it's here already? This time a week ago, I was surrounded by love watching Gail's favorite son, Will, marry his sweet Elise at my home. You can see the happy couple below. Everything about the day was magical, but I got real chills watching the couple say their vows. "I see you. I will always see you. I will always be here," they told one another. I like to think that in all my years doing the Oprah Winfrey Show, I learned a thing or two about love. The most important lessons always came from the ordinary people I spoke to. When it comes to weddings, one thing I know for sure is this. You've got to focus on the marriage, not just the big day. Once all the pomp and circumstance are over, and the party has wound down, what's left? You have each other, plain and simple. Weddings aren't a fairy tale ending. They're a beginning. With luck and hard work, they can be the beginning of something lasting, joyful, and dignified. That's my wish for Will and Elise. This week, I want to know, what advice do you give to young couples starting out? Or perhaps the question ought to be, what advice do you wish you'd been given? Let me know in the comments below. I can't wait to read them. Wishing you a Sunday as full of love as mine was last week. Go well, everybody. And there's a picture of Will and Elise, and Will is dressed in a white tuxedo with a black bow tie, and Elise is wearing an off-the-shoulder, puffy-sleeve wedding gown. And a couple of comments below. Nick Rondinelli says, for young couples starting out, I suggest embracing some unconventional advice to strengthen and build a strong, lasting relationship. Keeping separate bank accounts can help maintain financial independence and reduce money conflicts. Additionally, having a joint account for shared expenses ensures you can manage your finances together effectively. Waiting to have children lets you focus on building a strong bond and enjoy each other's company without the added responsibility of parenting. Setting clear boundaries with in-laws and extended family ensures your relationship remains a priority, preventing family issues from causing problems. Fight for what you have. Protecting your relationship means being flexible and willing to compromise in tough situations. Don't let others drain your energy and watch out for people who might be jealous of your relationship. Identify ankle grabbers and keep them at a distance to safeguard your bond. Start with complete honesty from the beginning. Sharing everything with each other sets open communication as the norm, helping to manage insecurities through honest talks and ensuring no secrets hurt your relationship. Supporting each other's individual goals is also important. Encourage and support each other's personal growth and dreams. A strong, lasting relationship allows both partners to thrive. And this one is from Sparkle King. Best relationship advice that I give my clients is something I learned in therapy when I was a teen. Everyone in my family was seeing the same therapist. My parents kept threatening a divorce that never happened. And he dropped the mic when he said, the best way to send an argument is to say, I love you more than this argument. It is so disarming that in the heat of the moment, the other person usually stops fighting because of its power. Try it sometime. I know it works. This next article is in Lifestyles under the Oprah Daily Insider Exclusive Previews. The article is entitled, This is Your Brain on Podcasts. Who's afraid to be alone with their thoughts? A whole bunch of us, it turns out. And the article is by Casey Hurwitz. Up until my early 20s, I relished being alone. In high school, I would jump on the opportunity to have the house to myself. Not, I'm reluctant to share, because I wanted to throw a rager, but because I was thrilled to order whatever food I was craving and settle in to watch an old Hollywood movie. But when I turned 25, all of a sudden, I couldn't be alone with myself. When I faced a weekend of solitude and couldn't depend on friends or family to FaceTime me through every minute of it, I turned to a different source of companionship, podcasts and audiobooks. I became a listening fiend. In 2023 alone, I zoomed through 79 audiobooks. That's more than 750 hours. Actually, on my average listening period of 1.5 times, it's more like 500. I consumed podcasts a little differently. I found two I liked, both involving two women chatting about random topics. Again, I hesitate to admit, one of which is Harry Potter. And I jump from episode to episode. My new besties' voices following me through making breakfast, folding laundry, and even showering. If I stopped listening to something for even a few minutes, my anxiety would rise. Thoughts spiraling and heart racing. And the only way my brain would shut up was if I plugged another story or conversation into my little dopamine machine. Turns out I'm in good company. When I asked my circles if they shared my addiction, many revealed they were just as guilty of using audio, mostly podcasts, as a coping mechanism for loneliness, anxious thoughts, and fear. My audio bibliophilia began during COVID, when it was just me and my dog for long stretches, says Kate Murphy, author of You're Not Listening, a book about listening mindfully. Having someone read to me was incredibly comforting and kept me company. But Murphy also acknowledges that she misses out on quite a bit with audiobooks. Some audiobooks elevate the actual book. Meryl Streep reading Ann Patchett's Tom Lake, for example. But I usually read the physical book at the same time to fully inhabit it. This is because we don't typically consume audio while staring at a blank wall and doing nothing else. So our focus is divided, explains Murphy. Attention is a limited resource. So if a portion of it is occupied, you simply have less bandwidth available. Ah, no wonder I can't remember half of the characters or plot lines from my 79 book streak. But the news isn't all bad. According to Carolyn Rubenstein, PhD, a psychologist and wellness expert who focuses on anxiety and fear, and an avid listener of nonfiction audiobooks and mystery podcasts, mindful listening can actually be really healthy. For those times I'm dreadfully anticipating a solo Friday night, the listening fills a temporary need. It can create a sense of feeling engaged, connected, or energized, Rubenstein says. Or if you're in an icky, sad mood, these podcast hosts can help you feel a sense of belonging and comfort. That's totally normal. The trick is to be mindful about it, Rubenstein continues. Make that choice in the moment and say, I'm okay with it. I'm going to think about those worries later. But right now, I need an intentional distraction. I give myself permission to take time off from those scary feelings. What you don't want to do is ignore the feelings indefinitely, because if you do, they'll probably bubble up at an inconvenient time, says Rubenstein. I asked her how to strike a healthy balance between tuning into my needs and tuning out the world. Track your patterns. Instead of mindlessly plugging in, consider how often you're relying on your emotional support podcast and how it actually makes you feel. I literally do an audit of my listening, Rubenstein says. She tracks how the audio affects her emotions. A simple happy or sad face will suffice, and uses that to inform future smart listening choices. Rubenstein says it's also important to recognize the why behind your constant listening. Is it always a source of enrichment, or is it distraction and avoidance? And that's the crux of the issue for many listeners. We'll do anything to avoid the voices in our heads. Unfortunately, though, it's necessary. Silence and listening to what's happening around you is critical for both grounding you and regulating your nervous system, explains Rubenstein. It's important for us to look at our thoughts and think about what we're thinking. But she recognizes that it's a huge feat to sit in silence without going into panic mode. Basically, you have to take breaks. Start small. Rubenstein recommends hitting pause for 5 minutes if you're in the middle of a podcast-accompanied walk. Slow things down. Another wise shift to make. Listen to your audio at its intended pace. The phenomenon of listening at double speed is called pod fasting, according to Murphy. And while it may make you feel like you're using your time more efficiently, it's actually harmful because it makes us more likely to get distracted when people are talking to us at a normal speed. So, a standard convo with your coworkers turns into a nightmare of impatience. Sort of like the feeling you get when you come off an expressway and have to go through a school zone, Murphy says. Keep real friends close. Audio is also a good connector because it's both intimate and authentic, says Siobhan McHugh, author of The Power of Podcasting, who has studied the art of audio for years. Most of us are listening in headphones, so it's just a direct relationship between me and the people talking to me, she says. That makes my preferred brand of podcasts, Chumcasts, as McHugh tells me they're called, even more brilliant at making me feel less lonely. I just have to be careful that I'm not depending on my besties who don't know I exist for all my social interactions. At some point, it can limit your in-person connections and willingness to go outside your comfort zone, Rubenstein says. For me, commutes are a time to check in with your friends and catch up. If I were instead listening to podcasts, I might notice, not consciously at first, that I'm starting to feel lonelier and disconnected. Beware of subject matter. Speaking of audio that might make you extra stressed, the theme does matter. I'm looking at you, people who can't fall asleep without a true crime podcast. If you're always checking behind you for a stalker or waking up from murder-riddled nightmares, maybe ease off the crime junkie. Rubenstein actually recommends finding audio that's like a bedtime story for adults. It'll still keep your brain away from that 11 p.m. spiral we're all so familiar with, but it's much more soothing. At the end of the day, episode? Spending a lot of time listening to podcasts or audiobooks isn't strictly unhealthy. You can learn a lot, combat some occasional mental or emotional discomfort, and enhance your connections. As with most things, moderation is key, Murphy says. Don't rely on substitutes if you can enjoy the real thing, for example, in-person interaction. But considering all the downsides of doom scrolling and screen addiction, listening may actually be a silver lining of the digital age. This next article is in Wellness. The four types of regret we don't recognize. Research says regret is valuable. It makes us human. It makes us better. Here's what you need to know. This article is by Daniel H. Pink. Regret. That stomach-churning feeling that the present would be better and the future brighter if only you hadn't chosen so poorly, decided so wrongly, or acted so stupidly in the past. Regret can be painful, of course. But this emotion is not dangerous or abnormal. A deviation from the steady path to happiness, it is healthy and universal, an integral part of being human. Regret is also valuable. It clarifies. It instructs. And that is not some gauzy daydream. That is what scientists have concluded in research that began more than a half century ago. In fact, the research can be distilled into two conclusions. Regret makes us human. Regret makes us better. A few years ago, I conducted two extensive research projects of my own. Working with a small team of survey research experts, we designed and carried out the largest quantitative analysis of American attitudes about regret ever conducted, the American Regret Project. We also launched a website, the World Regret Survey, that's worldregretsurvey.com, that has now collected more than 26,000 regrets from people in 134 countries. I found that nearly all regrets fall into four core categories: foundation regrets, boldness regrets, moral regrets, and connection regrets. Number one, foundation regrets. Many of our education, finance, and health regrets are expressions of the same core regret: our failure to be responsible, conscientious, or prudent. Our lives require some basic level of stability. Yet sometimes our individual choices undermine this long-term need. We overspend and undersave. We adopt unhealthy habits. When such decisions cause our futures not to live up to our hopes, regret follows. Number two, boldness regrets. One of the most robust findings in the academic research and my own is that over time, we are much more likely to regret the chances we didn't take than the chances we did. What haunts us is the inaction itself. Moral regrets. Most of us want to be good people, yet we often face choices that tempt us to take the low road. When we behave poorly or compromise our belief in our own goodness, regret can build and then persist. Connection regrets. Our actions give our lives direction, but other people give those lives purpose. A massive number of human regrets stem from our failure to recognize and honor this principle. Our everyday lives consist of hundreds of decisions, and some of them crucial to our well-being, many of them inconsequential. Understanding the difference can make all the difference. If we know what we truly regret, we know what we truly value. Regret, that maddening, perplexing, undeniably real emotion, points the way to a life well lived. Accompanying this article is a book entitled The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward, and it's by Daniel H. Pink. And you can purchase it now if you're interested for $15 at Amazon. We have our word of the week: screen apnea. Reading this on your phone? Don't hold your breath. No, really, don't. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Screen apnea. There's a psychological reason you feel tense when looking at your phone or computer. Screen apnea is what happens when you breathe irregularly or forget to breathe altogether while on a screen. Linda Stone, the tech consultant who coined the term, explains, "If you're opening an email or responding to a text, you might inhale, and then if another text comes in or you see a bunch of emails, you don't necessarily get that full exhale," she explains. "Then you end up in this cumulative, continuous cycle of shallow breathing and breath holding. It also doesn't help that most of us slump forward while sitting at a screen. The issue here, besides the number it does on our spines, is that our chests become concave, making it impossible to catch a full breath," adds Stone. Even more perturbing, this cycle of short, anticipatory breaths, "What horrors will blow up in my inbox today," and shallow to no exhales actually makes us feel more afraid. When our breathing is compromised, the part of the body that controls our reaction to stress, the vagus nerve, glitches, and we perceive threat even when it isn't there. One way to break this habit is to practice breathing exercises like the ones in our breathwork curriculum. Stone also suggests setting reminders to get off your screens every 40 minutes to an hour, not as a reward for finishing something, but to help you get more done, she says. Even standing up to stretch your arms and legs offers a reset. Our bodies are all rhythm. Our heart has a rhythm. Our gait has a rhythm, Stone says. When you're sitting in front of any screen and your breath is start, stop, you're disengaging your body from its natural healthy rhythms. So seriously, let out that big sigh you've been holding. This is from Culture and News. Sneak peek. Oprah joins Colman Domingo on new audio project. Listen to an exclusive clip from the play Wild with Happy Here. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. The moment is meta. Oprah, playing the role of a struggling actor's mother, asks her fictional son, "You want me to write Oprah? I wrote her 6 times already," when he mentions his struggles in his acting career. The scene comes from a play, Wild with Happy, that was written by Colman Domingo more than 10 years ago, and is now being adapted into an audio recording by Audible. Domingo voices the main character, Gil, the struggling actor, whom we meet just after the death of his mother, Adelaide. Gil is looking back on his time with Adelaide before her passing, of course, and the inspiration actually comes from Domingo's real life. His mother really wrote to Oprah before his career took off, and long before he starred in the 2023 movie version of The Color Purple. It's a full circle moment. Then, with Oprah voicing Adelaide in this production, the project, which was directed by Domingo, also includes Sharon Washington as Gil's aunt, Alex Newell as Gil's best friend, and Tyler James Williams as Gil's love interest. But Oprah Daily's exclusive and hilarious clip features that scene between Gil and Adelaide where she asks about reaching out to Oprah. It's a phone call between mother and son. Listen to the audio here or below. Wild with Happy is available for listening on Thursday, June 13th, exclusively on Audible. Hear the full recording with more fun and endearing tidbits from Oprah on Audible here. This article is from the wellness section. What did you say? Though you might not feel it until your 40s, hearing loss can start as early as your 20s, and the dangers from heart attacks to dementia are loud and clear. This article is by Rory Evans. Spin class is a vibe. The motivation, the pseudo-spirituality, the Palo Santo candles, but it's also a literal vibe, with music so loud you feel it in your ribcage, like it's giving you CPR. That was the appeal. I loved every part of it. I went 5 times a week and rode a bike in the front row near the speakers, says Liz David, who maintained that level of commitment to the spin studio in her Los Angeles neighborhood over several years. The thing about music that goes to 11, though, is that it can wreak havoc on your hearing. My husband would occasionally come with me, and I recall him saying, "I don't know how you can stand it in there. It hurts my ears," David said. It was hurting her ears, too. She just didn't realize it. "At first, I got what I now know was tinnitus," she says. I was always asking my husband, "Don't you hear that?" Like there was always a drain going in the background. While watching Game of Thrones or other dialogue-heavy shows with her family, she lost the plot unless they had closed captions on. Her frequent refrain at home was, "What did you say?" So much so that her teenage kids teased her about going deaf. Mostly to prove them wrong, she got a hearing test at UCLA. Since David was 48 at the time, neither she nor her audiologist had expected the results. She had mild to moderately severe hearing loss in both ears. "I was a candidate for hearing aids," David says. "I was shocked. I was gobsmacked." She underwent further testing with an ENT to rule out a medical cause for the loss and found that her hearing at some pitches was fine, but then fell off a cliff at a certain point. Given that the loss was equal in both ears, her doctor surmised that it was due to noise damage, which David assumes came from spin class. She stopped going after her initial test, and in the years since has not experienced further loss. I'm definitely more aware of the hearing I have left. Of course, you don't have to be tapping back to the Dirty South extended remix of Messiah to put yourself at risk. Hearing loss is completely normal. Sometimes it's genetic, but it also progresses with age. Starting in your 20s, says Frank Lynn, MD, PhD, director of Johns Hopkins Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health. Our oral environment just speeds it along. Sound-inducing hearing loss is the only type that is 100% preventable, says Sarah Sidlowski, PhD, audiology director of the Hearing Implant Program at the Cleveland Clinic. But we're seeing an uptick because we live in a noisy world. A safe listening level is about 85 decibels, akin to a blender or traffic or a loud restaurant, over 8 hours. That time frame cuts in half for every 3 decibel increase, though, Sidlowski says. If you're at 88 decibels, it's safe for 4 hours. 91 is safe for 2 hours. 94 for an hour, she says. A typical concert is about 105 decibels. So without earplugs, it's safe for about 5 to 7 minutes, or somewhere in the neighborhood of Virgo's Groove. But here's what's more alarming. Excessive sound exposure harms far more than your hearing. According to a 2022 study, noise-induced mental stress may lead to heart attacks, heart disease, stroke, and heart failure, and hearing loss is the single largest potentially treatable risk factor for dementia, Lynn says. This isn't just because auditory deprivation leads to brain atrophy, he explains. People with hearing loss also might not go out as much or see their friends. They're not cognitively stimulated as much. And we know that social integration and cognitive stimulation are super important for brain health. The great news is that addressing the issue makes a real difference. In a recent study of older adults at risk for cognitive decline, results demonstrably and definitely showed that treating hearing loss reduces the rate of cognitive loss by 48%, Lynn says. Data like that, he says, changes the whole dynamic of how you think about your hearing across your lifetime. Here then are habits and technologies to adopt now, no matter your age. Be aware of noisiness. The world works in mysterious ways. You don't even notice you exist in a general din, but can oddly key in to the sound of a coworker 2 desks away chewing a bagel. Technology can help you with the former. We can set alerts on our phones or watches if sound goes over a certain decibel level, says Debara Tucci, MD, director of National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. For instance, you can set a noise threshold on an Apple Watch, and it will notify you when you're exposed to harmful sound levels. To set maximum limits on earphones, search Headphone Safety in iPhone settings or Media Volume Limit in Android settings. Tucci also points out that we can run apps that tell us how loud the sound is around us. Try Decibel Pro or Sound Meter. Wear earplugs, and not just at night. There's a misconception that you can't hear what's going on around you when you're wearing earplugs, Sidlowski says. But what they actually do is turn down the volume by 20 decibels. So instead of hearing a concert at 105 dB, it's at the safe level of 85. The best earplugs, like the best sunscreens, are the ones you will actually wear, whether they're $150 custom-molded styles made by an audiologist, or the squishy orange ones from the drugstore. Sidlowski says to look for an NRR, noise reduction rating, of at least 20 dB, and to insert them correctly, because if it's hanging out of your ear, it's not actually protecting your hearing. To straighten your ear canal, gently pull back on your ear. Think Mr. Spock or the Nabi. Press the pinched up plug-in, then hold it in while it expands. Lynn, meanwhile, uses noise-canceling AirPods Pro during tasks like weed whacking, but upgrades to earmuffs for noisier tasks like mowing the lawn. Get checked. Taking a hearing test, something most Americans haven't done since they were 7 years old, Lynn jokes, can help you quantify the loss or establish a baseline to protect and compare against in the future. Mild hearing loss would mean that you have difficulty hearing in noisy situations but are fine in quiet environments, Tucci says. Moderate loss would be having difficulty even in quiet environments, like when you need to turn up the TV and everyone else in the room is fine. You can do a preliminary test using the Mimi Sonic Cloud or Jacoti apps, that's J-A-C-O-T-I, recommended by Johns Hopkins Hearing Number Public Health Campaign, or via the National Hearing Test, free for AARP members, or $8. If the results show that you've experienced loss, see an audiologist or ENT. If you go to an audiologist, Tucci says to consider getting your ears cleaned, too, since wax buildup can block the ear canal and hamper hearing. No, you're really not supposed to clean your ears yourself. Though if you insist, you can use a bulb irrigator to flush your ear canal with a mixture of water and vinegar, which has antibacterial properties. Try some tech. The next time someone talks to you with their AirPods in, it could signal that they want to hear you better, not tune you out. The iPhone's Live Listen feature employs your phone as a microphone that feeds into your AirPods, so you can hear better in a noisy restaurant, say. There's also an array of actual hearing aids and devices with made-for-iPhone technology for easy pairing. When you wear AirPods Pro, the Conversation Boost feature can also help you hear more clearly when someone is talking to you. Lynn is especially excited about eyewear giant Essilor Luxottica's, and that's Essilor Luxottica, all together, forthcoming Nuance Audio glasses, which look like Jenna Lyons-style chunky specs, but have microphones embedded across the top bar and have tiny speakers in the temples above your ears. Whoever you look at in a restaurant, you'll be able to hear, Lynn says. When I first put them on, I was like, oh yeah, this is better. It didn't feel so dramatic until I took them off and was like, I want them back on again. Consider aids. Of all the people who could benefit from hearing aids, we know that only a fraction of them wear them, Tucci says. That's because, unlike glasses, which help in literally the blink of an eye, hearing aids have a learning curve that can feel way too steep. Historically, the technology has amplified all sounds, the important ones as well as the insignificant, creating a relentless cacophony that your brain can take many months to learn how to filter. For lots of people, it just takes too long, and they end up in a drawer somewhere, Tucci says, despite costing upwards of $5,000 each. Such was the case for David, who found them unwearable in loud environments. Beyond the learning curve, there's the stigma and the shame. When Anne was in her early 40s and started wearing one in just her left ear due to genetic hearing loss, it felt like I was crossing a great divide that I didn't want to go to, she says. People just associate a hearing aid with being old. It's not cool like eyeglasses. insurance doesn't pay for it, which I don't even know what kind of message that is, that it's not as debilitating when you can't hear. I would give anything to be able to hear normally. The good news is that FDA approval of over-the-counter hearing aids went into effect in late 2022. So, the technology is improving, and the devices are becoming more affordable, practical, and wearable. The OTC versions now are as good as the prescription ones were a few years ago, Lynn says. For best results, Sidlowski recommends seeing an audiologist who can fine-tune the device to your exact deficit. As much as Anne hated crossing that great divide, she wears hers all day, every day. Though battery life is only about 2 days, so she stashes spare 312s in her bag. I rely so heavily on it, and I'm thankful for it, but I still wish I didn't need it, she says. I love it, and I hate it. Words that apply to so many aspects of getting old. This article comes from the Work and Money section. You're not bad at money. You've just been brainwashed. Here are three exercises that will help you ditch your self-limiting beliefs around finances and maximize your returns. This article is by Kara Lowenthal. Women are socialized to think that we are inherently bad with money, and this keeps us from living up to our financial potential. It's time to question the beliefs you've been taught and adopt what I think are the three most important money mindset principles you can have. I'm not here to tell you that you must create wealth, but it matters that you make your own decisions about how to value money. I want you to believe in your ability to create whatever returns you want, financially and otherwise, and to dismantle the male-dominated beliefs society as ingrained in you just because of your gender. With that, here are three ways to feel empowered around finances in any area of your life. Money Mindset 1. Understand the cost of your money thoughts. Many of us fear reclaiming our financial power because we're afraid caring about money means we're selfish or greedy. But when women refuse to even try to create wealth out of fear of self-judgment, it means that the people already at the top, mostly white cis men, retain their disproportionate resources. In other words, you're walking away without impacting the current distribution of resources. You're actually putting money in the pockets of those who already have the biggest share of it, and who may not share your priorities and values. Too many of us tell ourselves we don't care without actually doing the work of digging through our socialization to figure out whether we really don't care or just have been taught to pretend we don't. And we don't realize that opting out is effectively rubber stamping the current unequal systems. The following questions will help you uncover what your thoughts about money are and what new beliefs you want to work on building instead. Number 1, is money good or bad? Number 2, is it easy or hard to make? Number 3, what do you think about people who have/want to make a lot of money? Number 4, what do you think about people who do not have/want to make money? Number 5, do you want to make more money? Why/why not? Do you like these reasons? Why/why not? What do you think your answer from question 5 means about you? Do you like that response? Number 8, what do you want to believe about money? Money Mindset 2, know your worth, but not in the way you think. A very common piece of financial advice women receive is to know your worth, which is meant to be a motivational tool for negotiation. I hate this idea. Here's why. It collapses the concepts of financial value and human value into one thing. And then your brain can't keep them apart. When women believe that they need to negotiate for their financial worth as an exercise in demonstrating their personal worth, then emotions get all mixed up in financial negotiations. Think about it this way. If you believe that asking for a raise or a promotion is about proving your personal value, then the stakes are going to feel super high. If someone does not want to give you a raise, hire you, or pay your freelance rate, it's going to feel like they're telling you that you're not good enough as a human. But your personal worth can't be measured. It's not numerical. Humans have value just for existing, not for what they have accomplished. Financial negotiations are about financial and economic value. When you consider it from this perspective, you can make a better argument to demonstrate the economic value of your work. If someone can't see it, you can choose to accept the economic value they see in it, or to find someone else who recognizes the value you see in it. Regardless of what you choose, this makes it simply money math, not existential personal drama. If you find you're struggling around a financial negotiation, ask yourself these questions. Number one, what do I believe is at stake here beyond money? Number two, what will it mean about me if I get the amount I want? Number three, what do I imagine I will think/feel if I get the amount I want? Number four, what do I imagine I will think/feel if I don't get the amount I want? Number five, what will I make it mean about me if I don't get the amount I want? Number six, what can I practice thinking to separate my personal worth from my financial worth? Money Mindset 3. Know why your work matters. It doesn't matter if you're cleaning houses, selling diamonds, or working an office job. People exchange money for things they find valuable. If you're the one selling the thing, it's your job to explain its value. Women tend to have trouble doing this when the thing they are selling is their own work, whether labor, intellectual property, or ideas, because we've been socialized to underestimate the value of our contributions and to believe that thinking well of ourselves is arrogant. The result is that when women are selling themselves, we're starting from the subconscious belief that what we are selling isn't worth so much. That's a terrible negotiation tactic. Too many women believe that their value lies in being a workhorse. Every single accomplished woman I have coached has told me that they got where they are by working hard, that their value comes from their level of productivity. They never tell me that their worth comes from their strategic insight, creative thinking, or brilliant ideas. When you believe that it's just your literal hours worked that create your value, you will always feel like you need to be more productive, and you will not take vacation time or sick leave without feeling guilty. Being able to articulate the value of your work to yourself is the first step in being able to articulate it to anyone else. If you think of your work as unimportant or yourself as incompetent, that will show up in your returns. These prompts will help you build a better set of thoughts about the importance of your work. Number one, write down the job you have. Number two, what do you think makes someone good at that job? Make a list of characteristics, qualities, or actions. Number three, which of those match you, at least sometimes? Number four, how do you feel about yourself matching those criteria? Number five, what is the value that your work adds to other people's lives? Number six, what would someone else say is your special sauce, something you're uniquely good at in this role? Can't think of anything? Ask someone. Number 7. How do you think you would show up differently if you focused on those criteria and that value? Remember, the thoughts society has programmed into your brain about money don't serve you. They serve the established male financial interests. We live in a capitalist society, and opting out of it isn't really an option unless you want to live off-grid. So, if you're going to participate in society, you have to understand that when you avoid financial topics out of fear or insecurity, you're just rubber stamping the current system. The truth is, you are fully capable of understanding money. You are fully capable of creating more wealth. And you are fully trustworthy to steward your own financial future. Changing your thoughts about money is how it all starts. There is a book that accompanies this article. It's How a Sexist Society Gets in Your Head and How to Get It Out, Take Back Your Brain. And it's by Kara Lowenthal, and it's K-A-R-A, and the last name is spelled L-O-E-W-E-N-T-H-E-I-L. And this book is $29 at penguinrandomhouse.com if you're interested in purchasing it. Here's a gift suggestion for a teenager. It's a college gift, Pottery Barn Shannon Reversible Quilt and Shams. If your teen is leaving the nest, college move-in is closer than it seems. We've got you covered. This gorgeous Pottery Barn quilt is the solution to brightening up a dorm room. With reversible sides, she can pick her favorite and easily switch it up throughout the year. And this reversible quilt with matching shams is $41 at Pottery Barn. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.